Sure is. And we've got open lines again for you here on Coast to Coast AM on a Friday into Saturday morning, wherever you may be. And we will come right back to the calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, here we go. Let's go right back to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to South Carolina, east of the Rockies. Brian's with us. Hey, Brian, welcome.
Hi, George. How are you today?
Okay, thank you.
I got to tell you, I could spend an hour talking to you, but it'll only take about a minute and a half.
Go ahead.
I have a UFO story that happened to me about 18 months ago, and I wanted to share it because I was living in Gaffney, South Carolina at the time, and the news was telling us that the International Space Station was supposed to be flying by. And I'd gotten off work. I'm on my back porch, and there's a party going on across the lake from where I live. And I see what looks like a gentleman, like, riding in a canoe, like, pure white light, nothing. Like, there's a flight path because Charlotte's not too far in Greenville.
Okay.
So there's just pure white light. Guy looks like he's riding in a canoe across the sky. And I'm like, wow, that's, you know, that's amazing. I call my sister up. She was doing an internship with NASA. She's an aerospace engineer out of Georgia Tech. So I call her up and I'm like, Lisa, that was the coolest thing I've ever seen, you know? International Space Station is so pure, so bright. And she's like, Brian, the International Space Station is the size of a double-wide trailer. It's going to be a star going across the sky.
That's right. Like, it'll look like a dot.
Yeah, it would look like a dot, not like a full-blown guy in a canoe, like his body being up out of the canoe and the paddle coming down. So I cannot explain it. I don't know what it was. I just know that I could tell you half a dozen UFO stories from my family, and I come from a pretty professional family, so we're not like crazy, which is why I love your show, is that it's regular, genuine people that have actual interesting stories
from all over the place. How fast was it moving, Brian?
It wasn't like a speeding bullet. It was about actually the speed of a satellite. I summer in Maine. And so I see a lot of satellites, and it was probably the same speed. It didn't zip off or anything, but it was very clearly not an airplane, and it was a true unidentified flying object.
There's so many things out there. Thanks for that story, Brian.
Thank you very much, George.
So many things. Nick is in Hollister, California, and he's on Coast to Coast. Hey, Nick, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Great.
Hey, well, I don't know if you have time, but I have quite a bit of stories.
Well, let's start with your best one.
Or
should I say your favorite one?
Well, there's a couple. Well, the one of my favorite is that literally seen from the Bay Area where we live in Hollister. I see a bright ball, and I thought it was an airplane at first because there's something, a plane parallel in it, and it's coming directly towards me. And then all of a sudden I realize it's not a plane. It's a bright orb. And then it goes directly above me about 25 feet and then disappears.
Poof, gone.
Yeah.
And now, when you say orb, how big?
Oh, gosh, I don't know the size.
Like a basketball or bigger?
Oh, way bigger. It was just a bright ball of light.
Huh.
And that's one of the stories. I have quite a few. I mean, shoot, not just a couple of days ago, my parents and I was hanging out at their parents' place, and we saw three UFOs.
Clearly UFOs or maybe planes?
Oh, not planes at all. You can tell the difference. Brought the binoculars out and everything, and you could tell it had bright lights like airplanes, but it was more clear, and it was more like a ball shape.
And were they following each other?
Two of them did. The third was on the opposite direction of where we live.
What'd your parents say about this?
Oh, yeah, they thought it was interesting, too.
They did, so they didn't say, come on.
No. So, but the crazy part is I had one follow me one time.
Followed you where?
Well, it was about 6 months ago. I just moved out of my parents' place. I'm going to college and stuff.
Okay. What are you taking up, by the way?
Oh, I'm business management.
Good for you.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to do stuff that actually, you know, I can get a job.
Yeah, well, that's the important thing. You know, you want to spend 4 years in college and not be able to get a job in whatever you like. That's not worth it, is it?
Oh, heck no. Sheesh. But anyways, I thought what I appeared, because my parents have a shop for their business by their house, and I woken up because I thought I heard cars wheels going on the gravel next to the shop. So I get up, go out, check it out, nothing happening. Then I see a bright light. It looks like an airplane at first, across the way, and then all of a sudden it's like I could tell it's not moving. Then all of a sudden it moves south real quick and stops. And I'm sitting down watching this. I'm like, wow, that's pretty interesting. And all of a sudden it starts coming towards me. I'm like thinking, holy moly, what are we doing?
You just got to hope it doesn't come, Nick, and pick you up. Let me grab another call here, Nick. Three great stories, though. Let's go to a Mike in Jeffersonville, Indiana. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. What's new in Indiana?
Oh, hey, I love your voice. And is there any way I can get your job when you do retire?
Well, I'm not going to retire, but come on board anyways. We can always use more help. You never know.
I wouldn't retire either if I were you.
No. Just keep going.
Hey,
you know
George?
What? Let them carry me out of here.
Absolutely. I'll help.
Thanks.
I want your job.
Thanks, Mike.
Hey, listen, it's been like 10 years since I've heard Bob Lazar and Bill McDonald on your show. Are they still around?
Lazar, I think, was on not too long ago with George Knapp. McDonald is still around as well. I had him on a few years ago, so they're still kicking.
Yeah, but a lot of the newer listeners probably don't even know about those guys.
No, that's true.
They are absolutely two of my favorites, and their story is just absolutely fascinating.
Of the two, which one did you like the best?
Well, I think they both kind of go together.
Yeah, they complement each other, but do you find one to be more believable than the other, or about the same?
No, because Bob worked in Area 51, right?
Yep, he sure did.
And he actually had the hands-on with the craft, the skiff that they reconstructed. I'm assuming that was, or was that the original one?
No, who knows, but he claims he did work there. We've had some people on over time, Mike, who have tried to shoot holes in some of his stories, and he keeps coming back strong. He really does. Let's go to Don in Iowa, truck driving, first-time caller. Hey, Don, how are you?
I'm doing well, sir, and are you?
Good. What, do you live in Iowa, or you're just driving through?
Driving through, heading back to South Dakota.
All right. Be careful. What's up?
Oh, yes. Watching out for Bambi. So.
Bambi could seriously damage a car or truck, huh?
Yeah. I've encountered a few of them.
Yeah, they're there.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it definitely wakes you up.
For sure. Well, as long as we keep you awake, that's all that matters.
Oh, and you guys do an outstanding job. I listen to you every chance I get. I finally got the XM side, so now I have no problems getting you guys.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about going from town to town looking for us all over the place.
Exactly.
Yeah, if you're traveling all over the country, it's great.
Yes. Oh, it makes life so much easier.
Sure does.
So,
have you ever been in a truck stop area and all these folks are listening to the program at the same time? Does that happen sometimes?
I have not experienced that, but I don't get too off much in truck stops because I do a line haul where I'm at home every day. So,
oh, that's good. Well, that's good.
I drive from point A to point B, and and then I return each night. So, I haven't experienced that too terribly much. No.
What's the weirdest thing you've seen on the road?
Weirdest thing I have. Wow.
I bet you've seen so many things.
Well, there are a lot of things. There's a lot of times that I'm like, did I see that? Or is it just my eyes playing games on me, at nighttime, I guess you'd almost say falls into that the shadow people that you guys talk about every now and then.
Yeah, okay.
Like, did I see that? Maybe not. Cruising down the interstate, can't very well stop and take a look again. So
let's just hope you never see eyes in your rear view mirror.
definitely. That would be very spooky.
That I wouldn't like.
No, that might unnerve me to the point that I might have to quit.
Yep. I thought I saw that once in a car I was driving. For one split second, I see these eyes. You turn around, there's nobody there. And,
right.
You know, you don't know whether you should be relieved because no one's there or frightened because you thought there was something there.
Right. Well, yeah, why would you think there would be eyes there? You know, why would your mind put that there? And yeah.
Yeah. it's like driving knowing there's a snake in your car and you can't find it.
Yep, or a bee.
Oh.
You know there's a bee somewhere, and you can hear it, can't find it.
What a way to get into a serious accident, swiping at a bee in your car.
Yeah, try explaining that to the judge. That would definitely make for an interesting case.
Absolutely. Well, honk your horn for us, Donald.
All righty. Hopefully you can hear her.
I sure can.
All righty.
All right, my friend. Be safe.
All righty. Have a good night, sir.
Okay. Let's go to Dylan in Littleton, Colorado. Hey, Dylan, welcome to the show.
Hello, George. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
I was just calling because I wanted to ask your opinion on something, and I have this opinion on it as well. I was wondering if you could maybe, sway me to think of it differently.
All right.
Or I just actually want to hear
your
opinion on it.
Okay.
My question is, what exactly do you think about the concept of time? Because my opinion on it is it cannot be traveled, and I don't think it exists. I think the future and the past are not written, and the only thing about the past is that it's conceived in our memory.
Well, one, you got to listen to Monday's show because we've got a physicist scientist on who's talking about time travel. So this will be perfect for you. But the one thing about time, it's going too fast. It is ticking and ticking and ticking, and I can't slow it down. I wish I could. I mean, here we are. We're going to be going into September in a couple weeks. This is crazy. I mean, I just don't understand how fast things are going. Well, you get into September, folks, you're into Halloween, you're into Thanksgiving, and you're into Christmas, and you're into New Year's, and the year is done, and we're into 2012. Just like that. In the beat of an eye. And I just do not know where the time is going. I don't. Did I just pop my lips? Did I do that? Next up, let's go to Palm Springs, California. Eric, you're on Coast to Coast. Hey, Eric. Thanks for calling.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Okay.
Yeah, you know, this whole debacle of Wall Street, you know?
Yeah.
This thing about Wall Street. You know, I realized something about Wall Street, George, that I think it was a criminal thing to bail out Wall Street because you know how John McCain was talking about Wall Street as being like these gamblers. It's a gambling mecca. It's just gambling. That's all it is. But the difference is that when you go to the casino and you gamble and you lose money, the casino don't pay you back.
No, that's right. When you lose it, you lose it.
You go to the gate and you try to get your money, they're going to call a guard and they're going to throw you out.
You don't have your chips to go to the gate. That's it.
Yeah. So when the government, when Bush and them bailed out, and then also you have to realize they arguing about Obama, the market had fallen 2,000 points. Well, nobody's mentioning that when Bush was in, the market fell down. It was up at 16,000, went down to 7,000.
Yeah. I mean, look. No one is doing a good job out there in Washington. Nobody has. President Bush handed off a horrible situation to President Obama. He hasn't run with the ball the right way. It's a disaster.
Yeah. I mean, how did they dare to call this man that came in and then this idiot of Mitt Romney call him dog food today?
And we're going to see one of the most treacherous presidential races next year. Watch.
They're going to steal it, George. They're going to have to steal it because I'm going to tell you something. The president has a feel about it because the Democrats have to win the House, the Senate, and the presidency to do what they have to do to save the middle class.
Well, and let me tell you, and they're not going to be able to do that, unfortunately. You know, maybe the Libertarian Party is the one right now. I don't know. Maybe Ron Paul's the one to do it. I mean, of anybody, Democrats, Republicans. I'm nonpartisan, by the way. I call it the way I see it. If the guy's a Democrat, if the woman's a Republican, and if they're the best, they're the best. That's the way it is. That's what I call. I think a great president should get people from all walks of life and all parties into his cabinet or her cabinet rather than worry about a party. You know what? If a Republican's the best person, grab him. If a Democrat's the best person for that job, grab him. And don't worry about parties and party politics. But we'll see. You know, we're not going to hit on politics a lot on this program. That's not what we're here for. You get that during the daytime all the time. But we'll look at the edgy parts of the story. I mean, that's important because it does affect you. When I was young, never thought it affected me at all. I had a great news director. His name was Dick Graff. He's dead now. Guy was a genius. He'd look at my shows. I was a producer for TV shows in Detroit. He'd look at them and he'd say, what are you leading with that for? Change it. Let's do this. Lead with the budget story. And I went, no, Dick, it's boring. I'm not going to lead with a budget story. I'm going to lead with this double homicide in Detroit. That's exciting. And, you know, he would let me do my thing. And we had strong ratings, by the way. So that's why he let me do my thing. But years later, I realized he probably was right. And I was probably wrong. Yeah, I delivered the ratings and did what I had to do. But the bigger stories were the ones that people got bored with. But they were the most important for people. And I think I would change things if I did it all over again. Let's go to David in Anchorage, Alaska, west of the Rockies. Hey, David, thanks for calling.
Hi, George. Yeah, I hope this story isn't boring, and it is important.
So. Okay, and I've got a couple minutes for you before the break, so take it away.
Okay, the last time I called, my mother was actually on her deathbed, and I she had only a few hours to live, and I called Coast to Coast to talk to you about alternative science. And I'm not a cold person by any means, and so it had to have been pretty important. And I've called about probably 20 times to your show, talked to you about 20 times, and it's always been about alternative science.
Okay.
And I don't know if you recognize my voice at all, but...
I recognize the city.
Now, I want to tell you something that probably nobody's ever brought up before, and that's that if you... You've heard of Nikola Tesla.
Of course, yeah.
Now, Nikola Tesla... You probably don't know that he was head of a ministry.
Head of a ministry?
Yes.
No, I didn't know. I didn't know that.
The ministry was simply known as the ministry. Now that there was a team of the top Christian scientists in the world, and he was pretty much the spokesperson for them. It was a secret ministry, so people didn't know that. A lot of the stuff that he did was actually bringing the knowledge of the ministry forward. Now. This ministry has gone on for hundreds of years. It was originally started by Faraday. Faraday led it. And then a person named, well, later on, a fellow named Nick Stubblefield.
Who's got the gauntlet now? Who's running it now? Is it still around?
Yes, it's still around. Now let me give you a little bit of the...
Okay, well, I'm at the break here. So if you could just very quickly tell me where it is.
Timothy Thrapp is leading the ministry now. It's coming forward now. It's called WITS Ministry. They've changed the name. World Improvement Through the Spirit Ministry.
All right, I'll check that out. I'll be back in a moment, by the way, on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, on our next Coast to Coast program, of course, we've got Ian Punnett for you on Saturday and also Rob Simone on Sunday. Then I'll be back on Monday. And that first Monday night, Professor Ron Mallett on time traveling. He's trying to go back to find his father. Up next, my rendition of H.G. Wells' The Story of the Inexperienced Ghost.
The Story of the Inexperienced Ghost by H.G. Wells. The scene amidst which Clayton told his last story comes back very vividly to my mind. There he sat for the greater part of the time by the spacious open fire, and Sanderson sat beside him smoking the Broseley clay that bore his name. There was Evans, and that marvel among actors, Wish, who is also a modest man. We had all come down to the Mermaid Club that Saturday morning, except Clayton, who had slept there overnight, which indeed gave him the opening of his story.
We had golfed until golfing was invisible. We had dined, and we were in that mood of tranquil kindliness when men will suffer a story. When Clayton began to tell one, we naturally supposed he was lying. It may be that indeed he was lying. Of that the reader will speedily be able to judge as well as I. I say he remarked after a long consideration of the upward rain of sparks from the log that Sanderson had thumped, "You know I was alone here last night." "Except for the domestics," said Wish. "Who sleep in the other wing," said Clayton. "Yes, well," he pulled at his cigar for some little time as though he still hesitated about his confidence. Then he said, quite quietly, "I caught a ghost." "Caught a ghost, did you?" said Sanderson. "Where is it?" And Evans, who admires Clayton immensely, shouted, "Caught a ghost, did you, Clayton? I'm glad of it. Tell us all about it right now." Clayton said he would in a minute, and asked him to shut the door. We don't want to upset our very excellent service with any rumors of ghosts in this place. And this, you know, wasn't a regular ghost. I don't think it will ever come again, ever. "You mean to say you didn't keep it?" said Sanderson. "I hadn't the heart to," said Clayton. And Sanderson said he was surprised. We laughed, and Clayton looked aggrieved. "I know," he said, with a flicker of a smile, "but the fact is it really was a ghost, and I'm as sure of it as I am that I am talking to you now. I'm not joking. I mean what I say. It is the strangest thing that has ever happened in my life. You know, I never believed in ghosts or anything of that sort before, ever. And then, you know, I bag one in a corner, and the whole business is in my hands." "You talk to it?" asked Wish. "For the space, probably, of an hour." "Chatty," I said, joining the party of the skeptics. "The poor devil was in trouble," said Clayton. "Sobbing?" someone asked. Clayton heaved a realistic sigh at the memory. "Poor fellow, yes." "Where did you strike it?" asked Evans. "I never realized," said Clayton, ignoring him, "the poor sort of a thing a ghost might be. I took an advantage," he reflected at last. We were none of us in a hurry. "A character," he said, "remains just the same character for all that it's been disembodied. That's a thing we too often forget. People with a certain strength or fixity of purpose may have ghosts of a certain strength and fixity of purpose. I came upon him, you know, in the long passage. His back was towards me, and I saw him first. Right off, I knew him for a ghost. He was transparent and whitish, clean through his chest, and I could see the glimmer of the little window at the end. And not only his physique, but his attitude struck me as being weak. He looked, you know, as though he didn't know in the slightest whatever he meant to do." "What sort of physique?" said Sanderson. "Lean, shoulders bad, nearer than the hips, turned-down collar, ready-made short jacket, trousers baggy, and a little frayed at the heels. I came very quietly up the staircase. I did not carry a light, you know, and I saw him as I came up. I stopped dead at that, taking him in. I wasn't a bit afraid. I think that in most of these affairs, one is never nearly so afraid or excited as one imagines one would be. I was surprised and interested. I thought, 'Good Lord! Here's a ghost at last.' And I haven't believed for a moment in ghosts during the last 25 years. Said Wish. "I suppose I wasn't on the landing a moment before he found out I was there. He turned on me sharply, and I saw the face of an immature young man, a weak nose, a scrubby little mustache, a feeble chin. So for an instant we stood. Then he seemed to remember his high calling. He turned round, drew himself up, projected his face, raised his arms, spread his hands in approved ghost fashion, came towards me. As he did so, his little jaw dropped, and he emitted a faint, drawn-out boo. No, it wasn't. Not a bit dreadful. I had a bottle of champagne, and being all alone, perhaps 2 or 3, perhaps even 4 or 5 whiskies. So I was as solid as rocks, and no more frightened than if I'd been assailed by a frog. 'Boo,' I said. 'Nonsense. You don't belong to this place. What are you doing here?' I could see him wince. 'Boo,' he said. 'Boo, be hanged. Are you a member?' I said, and just to show I didn't care a pin for him, I stepped through a corner of him and made to light my candle. 'Are you a member?' I repeated, looking at him sideways. He moved a little so as to stand clear of me, and his bearing became crestfallen. 'No,' he said. And in answer to the persistent interrogation of my eye, 'I'm not a member. I'm a ghost.' 'Well, that doesn't give you the run of the Mermaid Club. What are you doing here?' I said. He had dropped his hands and stopped his booing, and there he stood, abashed and awkward, the ghost of a weak, silly, aimless young man. "I'm hunting," he said. "You haven't any business to," I said in a quiet voice. "I'm a ghost," he said, as if in defense. "That may be, but you haven't any business to haunt here. This is a respectable private club. People often stop here with nursemaids and children, and going about in the careless way you do, some poor little mite could easily come upon you and be scared out of her wits. I suppose you didn't think of that." "No, sir," he said, "I didn't." "You should have done. You haven't any claim on the place, have you? Weren't murdered here, or anything of that sort?" "None, sir, but I thought as it was old and oak-paneled." "That's no excuse," I regarded him firmly. "Your coming here is a mistake. I said if I were you, I'd vanish right away." He looked embarrassed. "The fact is, sir, that somehow I can't."
"You can't?"
"No, sir, there's something I've forgotten. I've been hanging around here since midnight last night, hiding in the cupboards of the empty bedrooms and things like that. I've never come haunting before, and it seems to put me out."
"Put you out?"
"Yes, sir. I've tried to do it several times, and it doesn't come off. There's some little thing has slipped me, and I can't get back." "That, you know, rather bowled me over. Come into my room and tell me more about it," I said. "I didn't, of course, understand this, and I tried to take him by the arm. But, of course, you might as well have tried to take hold of a puff of smoke. I had forgotten my number. I think, anyhow, I remember going into several bedrooms. It was lucky. I was the only soul in that wing until I saw my traps. Here we are," I said, and sat down in the armchair. "Sit down and tell me all about it. It seems to me you have got yourself into a jolly awkward position, old chap." He was telling me all about this wretched little life of his that had recently ended on Earth. He hadn't a particularly honest face, you know, but being transparent, of course, he couldn't avoid telling the truth.
"Eh?" said Wish, suddenly sitting up in his chair.
"What?" said Clayton. "Being transparent couldn't avoid telling the truth. I don't see it," said Wish.
"I don't see it," said Clayton, "but it is so, I can assure you, nevertheless. He told me how he had been killed. He went down into a London basement with a candle to look for a leakage of gas and described himself as a senior English master in a London private school when the release occurred."
"Poor wretch," I said.
"That's what I thought, and the more he talked, the more I thought. There he was, purposeless in life and purposeless out of it. He talked of his father and his mother and his schoolmaster and all who had ever been anything to him in the world meanly. He had been too sensitive, too nervous. None of them had ever valued him properly or understood him. He had never had a real friend in the world. I think he had never had a success. Engaged to be married, of course, to another oversensitive person, I suppose, when the indiscretion with the gas escape ended his affairs. And where are you now?" I asked. "Not in..." He wasn't clear on that point at all. The impression he gave me was sort of a vague intermediate state, a special reserve for souls too non-existent for anything, so positive as either sin or virtue, I don't know. He was much too egotistical and unobservant to give me any clear idea of the kind of place, kind of country there is on the other side of things. Wherever he was, he seems to have fallen in with a set of kindred spirits, and among those there was certainly a lot of talk about going hunting and things like that. Yes, going hunting. They seemed to think hunting a tremendous adventure, and most of them flunked it all the time. And so primed, you know, he had come. But really, said Wish to the fire, he was thinner and sillier and more pointless than if he had been real and alive. Only then, you know, he would not have been in my bedroom here if he had been alive. I should have kicked him out.
Of course, said Evans, there are poor mortals like that. And there's just as much chance of their having ghosts as the rest of us, I admitted. The mess that he had made of haunting had depressed him terribly. He had been told it would be a lark. He had come expecting it to be a lark, and here it was. Nothing but another failure added to his record. He proclaimed himself an utter out-and-out failure. He said, and I can quite believe it, that he had never tried to do anything all of his life that he hadn't made a perfect mess of, and through all the wastes of eternity he never would. He remarked that, strange as it might seem to me, nobody, not anyone ever, had given him the amount of sympathy I was doing now. I could see what he wanted straight away, and I determined to head him off at once. I may be a brute, you know, but being the only real friend, the recipient of the confidences of one of those egotistical weaklings, ghost or body, is beyond my physical endurance.
I got up briskly. "Don't you brood on these things too much," I said. "The thing you've got to do is to get out of this. Get out of this sharp. You pull yourself together and try." "I can't," he said. "You try," I said, and try he did. "Try," said Sanderson. "How?" "Passes," said Clayton. "Passes?" Complicated series of gestures and passes with the hands. That's how he had come in, and that's how he had to get out again. Lord, what a business I had. "But how could any series of passes," I began. "My dear man," said Clayton, "you want everything clear. I don't know how. All I know is that you do, that he did, anyhow, at least. After a fearful time, you know, he got his passes right and suddenly disappeared." "Did you," said Sanderson slowly, "observe the passes?" "Yes," said Clayton. "There we were. I and this thin, vague ghost in that silent room, in this silent, empty inn, in this silent little Friday night town. Not a sound except our voices and a faint panting he made when he swung. And suddenly he sat down on a little chair at the foot of the bed and began to sob and sob. 'You pull yourself together,' I said, and tried to pat him on the back, and my confounded hand went through him. I remember snatching back my hand out of him, as it were, with a little thrill, and walking over to the dressing table. 'You pull yourself together,' I said to him, 'and try.' And in order to encourage and help him, I began to try as well." "What?" said Sanderson. "The passes?" "Yes, the passes." "This is interesting," said Sanderson, with his finger in his pipe bowl. "You mean to say this ghost of yours gave away, did his level best to give away the whole confounded barrier?" "Yes." "He didn't," said Wish. "He couldn't, or you'd have gone there too." "That is precisely it," said Clayton. For just a little while there was silence. "And at last he did it?" said Sanderson. "At last he did it." Then he said peevishly, "I can't do it if you look at me. I really can't." "All right," I said. "I won't look at you," and turned towards the mirror on the wardrobe by the bed. I was alone, with the flaring candles and a staggering mind. What had happened? Had anything happened? Had I been dreaming? "And then you went to bed?" asked Evans. "What else was there to do?" "And about these passes," said Sanderson, "I believe I could do them now." "And that's what I'm going to do," said Clayton. "They won't work," said Evans. "If they do," I suggested. "You know, I'd rather you didn't," said Wish, stretching out his legs. "Why?" asked Evans. "I'd rather he didn't," said Wish. "Clayton," said I, "you're too good a liar for us. Most of it was all right, but that disappearance happened to be convincing. Tell us, it's a tale of cock and bull. You really do, you know, put things together, Clayton, in a most amazing fashion," said Sanderson. "But there's one little detail out." "I know," said Clayton. "I believe I could tell you which." "Well?" "This," said Clayton, and at a queer little twist and writhing and thrust of the hands. "Yes?" "That, you know, was what he couldn't get right," said Clayton. He stood up before the waning fire and smiled at us all. But I think there was just a little hesitation in his smile. "If I begin," he said. "I wouldn't begin," said Wish. "It's all right," said Evans. "Matter is indestructible. You don't think any jiggery, pokery of this sort is going to snatch Clayton into the world of shades? Not it. You may try, Clayton, so far as I'm concerned, until your arms drop off at the wrists." "I don't believe that," said Wish, and stood up and put his arm on Clayton's shoulder. "You've made me half believe in that story somehow, and I don't want to see the thing done." "Goodness," said I, "here's Wish, frightened." "I am," said Wish. "I believe that if he goes through these motions right, he'll go." "He'll not do anything of this sort," I cried, "and there's only one way out of this world for men, and Clayton is 30 years from that. Besides, and such a ghost, do you think?" Wish interrupted me by moving. "Clayton," he said, "you're a fool." Clayton smiled back at him. "Wish," he said, "is right, and all you others are wrong. I shall go. I shall get to the end of these passes, and as the last swish whistles through the air, presto, this hearthrug will be vacant. The room will be blank amazement, and a respectably dressed gentleman of 15 stone will plump into the world of shades. I'm certain, so will you be. I decline to argue further. Let the thing be tried." "No," said Wish, and made a step and ceased, and Clayton raised his hands once more to repeat the spirit's passing. By that time, you know, we were all in a state of tension, largely because of the behavior of Wish. We sat, all of us, with our eyes on Clayton, I at least, with a sort of tight, stiff feeling about me, as though from the back of my skull to the middle of my thighs my body had been changed to steel. And there, with a gravity that was imperturbably serene, Clayton bowed and swayed, waved his hands and arms before us. As he drew towards the end, one piled up, one tingled in one's teeth. The last gesture, I have said, was to swing the arms out wide open, with the face held up. And when at last he swung out to this closing gesture, I ceased even to breathe. It was ridiculous, of course, but you know that ghost story feeling? It was after dinner, in a queer old shadowy house. Would he, after all? There he stood for one stupendous moment, with his arms open, and his upturned face, assured and bright in the glare of the hanging lamp. We hung through that moment, as if it were an age, and then came from all of us something that was half a sigh of infinite relief and half a reassuring no, for visibly he wasn't going. It was all nonsense. And he had told an idle story and carried it almost to conviction. That was all. And then, in that moment, the face of Clayton changed. It changed. It changed as a lit house changes when its lights are suddenly extinguished. His eyes were suddenly eyes that were fixed. His smile was frozen on his lips, and he stood there, still. He stood there, very gently swaying. That moment, too, was an age. And then, you know, chairs were scraping, things were falling, and we were all moving. His knees seemed to give, and he fell forward, and Evans rose and caught him in his arms. It stunned us all. For a minute, I suppose, no one said a coherent thing. We believed it, yet could not believe it. I came out of a muddled stupefaction to find myself kneeling beside him, and his vest and shirt were torn open, and Sanderson's hand lay on his heart. Well, the simple fact before us could very well wait our convenience. There was no hurry for us to comprehend. It lay there for an hour, black and amazing still to this day. Clayton had, indeed, passed into the world that lies so near to and so far from our own. He had gone thither by the only road that mortal man may take. But whether he did indeed pass there by that poor ghost incantation, or whether he was stricken suddenly in the midst of an idle tale, as the coroner's jury would have us believe, is no matter for my judging. It is just one of those inexplicable riddles that must remain unsolved until the final solution of all things shall come. All I certainly know is that in the very moment, in the very instant of concluding those passes, he changed and staggered and fell down before us dead.
For Nathan Staten, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.